Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Steve McCallitz here.
Hey, Steve, and I understand Heather Forrest is on the line. We're in the process of getting the Adobe set up, and we are going to start momentarily. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Heather. I've got a lot of echo here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's my fault, probably. How are you doing?
I'm well. Are you back home, Steve?
Yes, I'm at home.
Yes. Okay.
And you?
I'm at work at home, yes.
Well, the meeting is in your neighborhood. It's in.
I know it is. I really shouldn't have an excuse this time, should I? No, I know.
Folks, while we're getting started, there are some signing lists coming around. If you could go ahead and complete those, I would appreciate it. Just to kind of run through the agenda very quickly while we're getting set up, during the open portion of the meeting, we are going to be receiving briefings from Krista Papik and Karen Lentz from GDD, Maggie Sarad from Compliance, and Margie Milam regarding the new Who is Accuracy tool. That will take us, unfortunately, pretty much straight through to 3:15, at which point we will go into a closed session for IPC members only. Folks who are on the phone, we're going to change to a different code, which I'm going to post to the IPC list momentarily as soon as I can get my computer up. So when we get to that point, if you want to participate in the closed portion, you'll need to hang up and dial back in. Why don't we quickly, while we're getting started, just go around, given that we have relatively few people, just identify yourself, your affiliation, and whether or not you're an IPC member. Christina Rosette, Covington & Burling, IPC president.
Paul McGrady, Winston & Strawn. IPC member.
Pat Rimfort, FICPI, IPC member, member of the NASA Council.
Peter Durenbach, Winkler Partners, IPC member.
Dana Brown Northcott, Amazon, IPC member.
Fabricio Vara, Time Warner, IPC via INTA, COA.
John McElwain, Nelson Mullins, I'm also IPC member and their representative on the NOMCOM.
Alex Deacon, Motion Picture Association of America, IPC member.
Griffin Barnett, Silverberg, Goldman, and Bykoff, IPC member.
Don Moody, New GTLD Disputes, IPC member.
David Einhorn, Baker Hostetler, representative of the IPO to the IPC.
Greg Shatton, Reed Smith, IPC member, alternate representative to the Standing Committee on Improvements.
Phil Morano, Catton Mushin, IPC member.
Mark Trachtenberg, Winston & Strawn, IPC member.
Michael Adams, Mayor Brown, IPC treasurer.
Jonathan Zook, ACT, IPC mascot.
Karen Malinchar-Uvel, Mark Monitor, Thomson Reuters, IPC member. Claudio DeGanchi, International Trademark Association and IPC Secretary.
Yes, Mario Elliman, IEEE, Region 9.
Festa Sugu, Upper Link Limited, representing Upper Link Limited.
Ireti Aladimiji from Nigeria.
Chris Lahead, ICANN.
Ellen Shankman from Israel.
Chia Yukun, Baker McKenzie.
Aaron Hickman, ICANN staff.
Maggie Surratt, contractual compliance.
Hubert Wellemann, SIDN.
Judy Harris, Reed Smith.
Lai Chan Loi from Adisio.
Jim Davis, Elevation Legal.
Trevor Little, World Trademark Review.
Gregor Morel, Brights Consulting.
Marianne Georgelin, AFNIC.
Ricky Lee, Brema Toxio.
Carol Douglas, Trinidad and Tobago, newcomer, fellow.
Hi, Stephanie Aquar from Kipelet.
Mark Atlassic, Checkmark Network. Sylvain Hirsch, IP Trends, applicant for membership to the IPC since over 1 year.
Connie Hahn, IP Mira.
Luc Chevalier, IP Twins.
Christine Durant, National
Oh, yeah. Good thing Jonathan's not wearing a dress.
Christine Durain, National Arbitration Forum, not an IPC member.
Fred Fellman, Mark Monitor.
Peter Lamanti, Authentic Web. Where's this go?
Super. And then folks on the phone.
Steve Metalitz, representing COA, IPC Vice President.
Ellen Shankman, calling in from Israel.
Heather Forrest, Australian Catholic University, IPC representative on the study group on country names, country and territory names.
Do we get everyone? All right. According to my notes, I think our first briefing is going to be from Krista. She's here. Right. We'll give her a minute to arrive. Do you have all the PowerPoints, Claudia? Just as a refresher, Krista is going to be briefing us on TLD startup issues as well as issues relating to kind of the intersection of GDD and compliance. Karen Lentz will be talking with us about the plans and preparations for the new GTLD reviews that are required. And then, you know, Maggie and Margie will be presenting on compliance and the WHOIS accuracy tool, respectively. I'm going to send a reminder email very quickly to Krista and let her know that we're in. Can you? All right. Just a couple things to recap. There, as a follow-up from the CSG meeting with the board, after the meeting, Fadi approached Elisa and I and asked that we set up a short meeting to cover some of the compliance-related issues. So we're waiting for a time on that. It's my understanding that it'll be a relatively small space physically. So I think at this point, until I get further information from his assistant about how big a room we're going to be in. I think it probably will be just the folks who presented on those issues today. But obviously we'll keep you all apprised. I don't know, while we're waiting for Krista Penner, since Brian isn't here yet, is there anything on the, other than the RAA issue, which I think we need to discuss in closed session, is there anything on the GNSO Council agenda for tomorrow that you have questions about or that you need guidance about?
I just looked at the updated agenda I sent out earlier today, and apart from what you said, I don't think so.
Then in terms of membership applications, there are a number of applications that are pending review by the IPCC. We're waiting for final input from them based on the membership committee recommendations. One of the issues that came up, that came up during the context, during the membership committee review, is an issue that we faced before, namely, you know, how do we process membership applications from contracted parties? There's been an issue about amending our bylaws. So I think what, and we'll talk about this more in closed session, is I think kind of going forward, all contracted party applicants who are approved for membership will be advised that the IPC is revising its bylaws and that depending upon those changes, that it may be necessary for all, you know, frankly, and I think we'd have to extend it to all applicants to reapply. I know this is an issue that we've grappled with for some time, but I think it's going to be important that we get the bylaws revisions done, and that's something we're going to talk about in terms of timing in the closed session. So I see Krista has arrived. So, no, that's okay. I'll turn things over to you. I don't know, do you have a... We have a presentation laptop, or you want to just use yours?
No, I don't have a
presentation? Okay. What I'd like to do is while Krista's pulling up some information, if we could, I'm going to start taking a cue on folks that have TLD startup-related questions. So start thinking about what it is that you'd like to hear Krista speak on. And with that, I'll kind of turn things over to you.
Thanks, everybody. Krista Papik from the Registry Services team, part of the DNS industry engagement team. I don't know why you guys got the short microphone. It's so bizarre. So I apologize for, one, for being late, and two, I anticipated this was more of a conversation than a presentation, so I don't have any slides, which I'm sure you're disappointed about that. With respect to the interaction between the GDD team and the compliance team, I know Maggie's here, and she's going to talk to you in a little bit. And I'm not really sure exactly what you guys are, what the real question is, but there's definitely, you know, we have the compliance function. I'll let Maggie talk about all the work she's been doing there. But there's certain points in time where the obligations of the registries begin. So in some cases, it's once they sign the agreement, generally speaking, and in other cases, it is upon delegation. And so certainly, as TLDs are getting delegated, there are systems that we use for monitoring and for them to report and provide things like the data escrow reports, et cetera. And if those aren't coming in the way they're supposed to, sometimes there's, frankly, an operational problem on ICANN's side where we haven't quite synced up our systems correctly, and sometimes there's an issue with the registry. And so what we have done recently is realizing that there's not really a test time frame for this compliance piece these obligations. It's just you're delegated, which could happen in the middle of the night in their time zone. And if there is an issue with the ICANN systems, we won't know until the delegation occurs, because oftentimes it has to be live in the route for these things to occur. So what we've done recently through lots of conversations internally is figure out a process for when those things do happen, determining whether there's an issue on the ICANN side, so ICANN can work to resolve it very quickly, or if it's on the registry operator side, certainly the compliance process, which doesn't change, it's the same process with the same timelines and interactions, has the ability to occur. So I don't know if that is the type of information you guys were looking for. Okay, great. And I don't know if there's a question.
During our regular calls, there have been a lot of questions and on the list questions raised about TLD startup, Sunrise, premium names, et cetera. So I'm going to go ahead and take a cue.
Sure. So I think one of the issues has been whether the information is getting posted quickly enough, I guess, because the sun, I guess, whatever the clock starts ticking on the 30-day notice for the sunrise period. I guess there might have been cases where things maybe got maybe put up a little late or something like that. Is that something you guys are, how are you guys working through that, I guess, is the initial question.
Sure. So with respect, if I could maybe give some background and then get into the meat of your question, Claudio. Krista Papik again. The TLD startup information, or the Sunrise portal as it's sometimes called, or the page where all the sunrises are posted, all meaning the same thing. My understanding of the background of this, because I was an ICANN staff at the time, but as we were working through the Trademark Clearinghouse requirements and the RPMs document and all of those things, the ask, I believe, came from IPC was to have some sort of, you know, place where you guys could go see, and brand owners in particular could go see what sunrises were coming and order for their own planning. And so as we engaged in that software development effort with a vendor by the name of Four Kitchens, I think we did something we don't normally do, but we should be doing more often. So I think it was a good learning lesson for us. But was to engage with the people that were requesting this product and to say, hey, you know, what do you guys think it needs to include, and what do you want? My understanding is we did go through that. We developed the portal, and we launched it. And the information, like all software development efforts, it has been less than perfect, but we've been adjusting on the fly. I know that we got some feedback. I can't remember. It might have been from you, Christina, about it's hard to tell what the date when stuff was, you know, the actual date that we posted it. So we made that adjustment. There's been a few adjustments that we've made to try and make it as user-friendly as possible. As I'm sure you guys know more than we do, the challenge – oh, I know the other thing we added was the ability to export all of the data so it was easier for you to manipulate it. So it's a combination of you don't know what you want until you don't have it situation, right? So while we did come and talk to you and say, hey, what are you guys looking for? How can we make this usable? It's hard to know what makes it usable until it's not usable. So we continue. The first thing I'd say is I encourage you guys to continue to provide us with feedback and let us know. And if there's ways that we can fix it or make adjustments or add features or functionality that will make it more useful, we're happy to look into that. The second problem is one I don't know how to address, which is there's a lot of data. And it's data that they have to provide and that you want to know about. And I'm again, happy to work with you to try to understand if there's a way to make it more navigable, if that navigable, yes. Look to the lawyers who are the word people. Don't play words with friends with this room. but, you know, we'll do our best to make those improvements, but a lot of data is a lot of data is a lot of data, so that's kind of part of the problem. To your specific question, and just as a data point for you guys, I have been personally handling all of the Sunrise stuff because on the front end is actually worked pretty well. I know there's some things that you're not happy about, but the back end, the software development for that, this was more important, so it's a little bit more painful on the back end. And anyway, we've finally gotten to the point where I can transition this off to somebody else and don't have to personally handle it. But I actually have personal knowledge of what's been going on with the posting because I've literally handled everyone. To my knowledge, there hasn't been, I mean, I've been very diligent about complying with the rules of the RPM's document. And so anyway, to my knowledge, there isn't. If you have examples, though, I would please encourage you to submit them. Feel free to send them even to me, and I can look into it and see what's occurred.
I know I have a question. Does anyone else have a question, want to get in the queue, or anyone on the phone want to get in the queue? All right. I know Claudia wanted to raise a question. The question I have is that I've noticed that from time to time, there are strings for which, even though the information has been previously posted, it'll have a newer, more recent posting date, and I'm wondering why that is.
Yes, so I actually was doing a test this morning so I could answer this question and then forgot to check what the results of the test, but I have it right here. So yeah, and you're talking about the published date that we added. Yeah. Yes, so what is happening with that is that they do have the ability, with certain constraints, again, as specified in the RPM's document, they do have the ability to modify dates. Some of them put the dates in their policy documents, so the policy document clearly articulates the different periods, which, you know, makes sense because those get posted on the registry's website, and that's where people go for information. So when they move a date within the rules of the RPM's document, they need to update their actual published documents. So I don't know exactly how the technology works on the back end, and I can look into that for you. But for instance, there's a real life example this morning for .coupon, Q-P-O-N, where they had that. They had a date movement. And they updated their policy document, and I had to go in and repost it. And so now you'll see that it has a March 24th date rather than a March 21st, which was when it was originally posted.
That's kind of what I thought. I know this has been a really challenging process. If there would be a way to somehow designate that for this particular TLD, the startup information had been posted before, but because of a change, it's being reposted, just so that we have a better sense of what it is when we're looking at it, trying to figure out how deep a dive you have to go, and et cetera. If that's possible, I think that would be really helpful.
Let me take that back and see. I oftentimes I think something sounds like it'd be really easy, and it's, you know, and vice versa. I'm not quite sure how we would do that, but the guy that helps me with this stuff is actually pretty clever, so I don't want to say it would be too tough yet. Thanks.
Thanks. So one of the issues that we've been noticing, and I think this is relating to how the RPM requirements document was finalized, but it might also be a compliance issue. So I kind of defer to you on that, Krista, but the registry agreement allows the registry operator to reserve I don't think there's any limit on the number of names that can be reserved and then later allocated after the sunrise period. They would still be subject to the claims notice but could not be registered during sunrise, which if the registry operator, you know, reserved a good number of the names that are in the clearinghouse, for example, those couldn't be registered. And that would completely defeat the purpose of the sunrise period. So we've identified that as an issue, and we're looking for resolution on that because, you know, clearly if registry operators are interpreting the contract that way, that needs to be addressed.
So if they're interpreting, sorry, can you just, if they're interpreting the contract, which way?
If they're engaging in that practice, it shouldn't be allowed because it's defeating the entire purpose of the sunrise period.
So with that, I'm gonna actually channel Maggie a little bit here, which is it's difficult without having a concrete example. It's hard to look into it, and so I don't really I would appreciate either you guys can there's multiple options, right? There you can let us know about it, but really you could even just submit a compliance ticket on this, and the compliance team would follow up on to see if there are issues with them being, you know, complying with their agreement, or if they're doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Thanks very much. John?
John McWayne for the record. On that same sort of topic, one of the issues that we've noticed is that with 3.2 and 3.3 of Spec 5, there's two different lists that could be of domain names that could be reserved. 3.2 is limited to 100. 3.3 is sort of unlimited, which is what Claudia was getting at. In Spec 5, ICANN is empowered to request a list of those domain names, and it would be a way to sort of have a check, because when you have those two different lists but no way to tell what's on it, a registry operator can move domain names back and forth on that, you know, as opposed to 3.2 or 3.3 to suit their own needs. So, you know, we would ask if you could request a list of the domain names that have been reserved under both of those sections as a way to just provide some transparency and a check to make sure that, you know, this is all being done properly.
So, Krista, again, I'm dancing dangerously close to Maggie's territory, but and if she comes and stands over me, you guys will know. They can the compliance team, if they do have a concern, they can request a list, and I think she can talk to you a little bit about that more in her update or in just a moment here. With respect to, I think part of what you're saying is to request it now. The problem with that is that those lists can change at any time as well. And there's no way of actually knowing if you have the up-to-date list or not. It's something that we can definitely take under consideration, but my initial, like when I hear that, my first reaction is that list, it might be good as of right this minute in time, but it could change in the second after I receive it, or not me, but she receives it. I don't know if Maggie wants to add.
So we have requested the list when we have specific reports to validate against. But to Krista's point, that list is forever evolving. So we take it on a case by case. And we keep it confidential within the complaint, within the scenario that it's been addressed.
Phil, and then I know Krista has to go. So is there anyone else that wants to get in the queue? I'm going to put myself back in, but Phil.
Hey, Phil Moreno, Catton Muchin, for the record. So you had asked about a specific example of, like, when Sunrise, when TLD startup information was supposed to be provided. So .ruhr in December 2013, they provided their 30 days with their TLD startup info. And then it appears as though it wasn't posted to the website until, like, 5 to 7 days later, meaning that folks who were checking that website for the 30 days notice only really got 25 or 23.
So I'm happy. I don't think you guys want to wait while I look through the system for it right now, but I'm happy to look into it and see that. I know we've had some website issues, so it's also possible that could have been a result of it. The other thing that happened early on, and is probably not the case because I know you, Phil, and you're looking so on top of this stuff and probably know more about this portal or this page than I do, but is that when we actually changed this, where is my page? So the default used to be to hide. Oh, no, that would be closed. Never mind. Let me take it offline with you, but I know that we have had issues with some things that weren't populating the way they were supposed to. And every time, like, I process a Sunrise, it's supposed to publish to the site within 60 minutes, and they do. But I don't actually go to the web page, and then there's actually about three steps before that have to occur. So I don't go in and, like, validate that it published. I sort of trust the technology that these are being published. So what happens is, and again, I would encourage you, if you see things like that, that's an operational, you could submit a compliance ticket or something like this. Like, the only way I find out is if somebody catches it. And sometimes it's actually me that catches it, but sometimes it's someone else. So anyway, I'll take this specific instance offline with you. But again, I'll reiterate, to my knowledge, everything's been strictly in compliance with the RPM's document. So thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to put myself in the queue, and then unless anyone has a really burning question, I think we're going to thank Krista and move on to Karen so we can stay on schedule. So I'm sure you're not surprised to know that the IPC has some concerns about the Dot Sucks $25,000 sunrise. So here's the question. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that at the end of whatever contention resolution mechanism is used, the applicant that is on record is saying that they intend to charge trademark owners $25,000 a name is in fact going to be the registry operator. All right? So it's kind of a three-part question. Sorry. First, if there is nothing in the RPM documents that are submitted to ICANN, but it's a matter of public record, is ICANN able to pull in public information when evaluating those? And second, and maybe I shouldn't be using DotSox, but we have a specific example, is that type of arrangement, which has, and as far as I can tell, seems to be intended to have the effect of really putting trademark owners in the position of having to pay really major amounts of money, is that something that's taken into account in the process of approving that RPM? If you want to get back to us later, that's fine.
No. It's okay. I just wanted to write it down so I don't forget. So pulling in the public info. So one thing that happens is when we are made aware of things, and sometimes it's something I've read, sometimes it's something somebody sent, sometimes it's something someone else in the company has read. I mean, it comes from all different ways. So if we are made aware of things, we will look into them. Somebody has to know to send it to compliance, so it could be, you know, the woman that works at the front desk, and she might read that and think it's interesting and not think, oh, wow, I should tell, you know, Maggie's team. But if it makes it, you know, we get things in various ways, and sometimes it's from staff or something we come across on our own, tweets, whatever. So we do our best to capture what we can, but you guys know how compliance function works at ICANN. There does need to be a complaint, but again, we see something that doesn't look right, we send it to compliance. So in this example, if, you know, we were to read about something like that, which I'm sure somebody would, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody would come across that on staff and would submit it or have somebody look into it, that would occur. As far as do we review that in the I think the second part of your question is, and you promised me three parts. Are you saving the best for last?
No, I decided it was really part of the second part.
Okay. So when it comes to the second part, do we take the pricing into account when we review the RPMs? I think you guys have heard this 100 times from ICANN. When it comes to pricing, we don't get involved in pricing. It's not something that has fallen under our remit. But we would review, and we do, I don't know if you guys have seen this. One of the things that we do is so if you look at the RPMs document, which I'm sure you have, it says that we'll review the startup information, but we won't sort of get in the way unnecessarily, and we won't, you know, make it this big deep dive review. We still do actually look at so we do that on the front end, but we go back and look at the policies in more depth once we've processed the information and it's posted. And if we see things that don't seem right, which is another reason you would see updates, we'll go back to the registry and say, hey, you say this in your document. Most of them are actually, they say something that it's not clear if they're, we think they're doing X, which is the right thing to do, but we want them to make it more explicit. So oftentimes we have them make the change to incorporate that explicit, you know, statement. For instance, limited registration period. Please confirm that you're not going to allocate those until after sunrises have been allocated, that kind of stuff. If we do see something that falls outside of, again, what we do, what is our remit, we will go back to them and ask for clarification. And if it's outside of what it should be, then there's a conversation that has to happen. So
let me just recap, make sure I have this right, that basically as long as the policy is on its face compliant with Sunrise, if the registry operator's stated implementation will have the effect of circumventing Sunrise and that implementation involves pricing, there's really nothing that ICANN can do. Is that right? Again, if you want to get back.
Yeah, so I mean, That's one way to put it. Again, if there's something that's concerning, we, like, and with this particular situation, we're well aware of it. We are monitoring, you know, not Maggie monitoring, but, you know, the company is monitoring this and watching to see what evolves. So, you know, again, the party line is always, you know, we don't get involved in pricing. That's not our remit. We do, however, watch this stuff closely, and the goal is for, you know, the sunrise period to do what it was intended to do. So,
well, thank you very much. We very much appreciate it. And I think next we're going to hear from Karen.
Christina?
Yes, Ellen.
Hi. I'm sorry to interrupt while you're waiting for the next speaker to come up. May I ask a question in the last one?
I think she may have. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I understand that the definition of what will be worked on is whether or not it's inside the remit or outside the remit. Have the boundaries of what that remit is been clearly identified?
This is Krista again. That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, the RPMs document is defined. We try, and that document gets worked on, not by, you know, ICANN facilitates that. These are things that driven by the community. The goal is to always have these things be well defined. But again, it. Sometimes we get to this implementation phase in, of things. And so I think when it comes to the rights protection mechanisms, I think that we tried to, I mean the collective we, the community, do our best to write something that does clearly define what those things are. It's in the bigger scope of things, the contract and contracted parties and what they can and can't do, it's... that's something that continually evolves, and it, you know, it's why we get new consensus policies and things like that. So I think that clearly defined is, that's a slippery slope to really try and figure that out, because as the dynamics of the market change as well, so do the definitions of things and what's happening and what needs to be addressed. So I know that's not a black and white answer, but neither is the situation.
Yeah, no, I'm not asking for a clear... I think that my concern is not that I expect ICANN to have clear boundaries already, but when questions are being raised in what are clearly concerns raised by the IPC and others in saying that they're raising it with you because they assume it is within your remit, that when you've decided that something is outside your remit, that you identify and say, well, you know, we thought that was in there, but in fact it's not.
So if the... For instance, if the compliance team, Krista again, if the compliance team were to receive something that is outside of their remit, so again, if there's something that's happening that shouldn't be happening or you believe shouldn't be happening, I encourage you to, you know, submit a compliance ticket. And once they do their work, and this, again, this is more Maggie's scope than mine, but once they do their work, if they find that... that it's outside of the scope of the agreement or outside of, you know, whatever, then they will you will be notified of that. It doesn't just disappear. Is that, I don't know if that's the question, though.
Krista, I just wanted to clarify just for the record. It's Claudio DeGangi. When you said that ICANN doesn't get into pricing issues, you were really referring to the new GTLDs, because the legacy GTLDs have price caps like ComNet, Biz. They're all under basically a pricing regime. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thanks for the clarification.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Karen Lentz, for those who don't know me, Director of Operations and Policy Research at ICANN. I was asked to speak to you briefly on the topic of plans and preparations within ICANN for reviews of the new GTLD program, which is a little bit of a timely topic because you've started to hear a little bit about it this week in Singapore. And also, we're kind of at the stage in the processing of applications that we are starting to look ahead and are having the types of conversations internally about organizing, and we're also in the middle of the budgeting process, so making sure that we've identified all of the projects and efforts that are needed to begin and get those reviews underway. Make sure that they're adequately resourced and can be done in a timely and effective way. So I don't have a slide. I would just kind of roughly divide the activities into four buckets. The first being the affirmation of commitments review. So section 9.3 of the AOC provides that ICANN will do a review of a number of elements of the program, specifically whether the extent to which it's promoted competition, consumer choice, and consumer trust. It mentions the effectiveness of the application and evaluation processes, and it also mentions the effectiveness of the safeguards that were put in to mitigate issues that were identified during the development of the program. So those would include, for example, the malicious conduct measures and the new trademark protections. So with that one, there is some activity happening now in the form of an implementation assistance group who's working on metrics. This is in relation to a set of 70 recommended metrics that was created by the GNSO and ALAC, covering the competition, consumer trust, and choice aspects. So this group is actually chaired by Jonathan Zuck here, and he can probably update you more thoroughly than I can. But that group has been tasked with providing advice on implementation in terms, and has gotten into the review of the metrics in terms of which ones require a baseline, how feasible are some of the things that are recommended. So those discussions are happening now. There's been the group has made an early recommendation to the board to fund a consumer survey and an economic study. So that's a recommendation that's before the board here at this meeting. But the timeline on that is approximately July. The group's expected to have a report to the board, and then making implementation recommendations on metrics. Following that will be the actual formation of the review team and those proceedings and their report and its consideration by the board. So that's kind of one bucket of work there. Another bucket is some I'll just call them additional reviews that are have been mentioned or committed to in other places. One has to do with route scaling, which was a commitment made in the GAC discussions. So that is considering the effects of delegations of new GTLDs on security and stability. That's being accounted for in the project planning and budgeting process. As well as there's also, this was one of the SDI recommendations, that the URS be reviewed 1 year after the first date of operations, which if you think about when the first new GTLD was delegated was around October. So potentially that's when the first URS case could have been filed. So a year after that will put us in Q4 of 2014. Another bucket of things that were taken into account is what you might call the operational aspects from looking at the mechanics of the program in terms of the evaluation process and criteria, the objection processes, contention resolution, all of those things. And we've actually already had some debriefing along the lines with the initial evaluation, just to make sure that the experiences are captured and the lessons are captured well. It's still relatively recent. So that's the third bucket. And then the other thing that I'll just mention, which is not really a review, but it's related, is that there's potentially a GNSO policy track of activities as well. And I don't have a or we don't have an expectation of what that might be, whether it's a PDP, a broad one, or a specific one where there's some additional form of policy guidance or review that the GNSO would do in terms of the policy and the implementation. So we're really looking to the GNSO to kick that off, which they have started to discuss this week. And I'll just close by saying there seemed to be a concern in the GNSO meeting over the weekend that staff already had a grand plan of how to do all of these activities, and it was going to be implemented without consultation. That's really not the case. That we're the stage that we're at is pretty much what I've just shared with you in terms of looking forward and making sure we are supporting the activities that we expect to be happening. So I think that's covers it. I'll take any questions or comments.
All right. Thanks, Karen. I'll take a cue. Okay, Jonathan first. Anyone else? No? Okay.
I'll just add very briefly to what Karen said about the study that we asked for among the preliminary recommendations of the board. Karen referred to it as an economic study, but a big part of that is going to be pricing strategies and the effect that those pricing strategies have on consumer trust, et cetera. So, some of the issues that are really important to the IPC would potentially be a part of an economic study that was requested to the board.
There's a question in the remote participation from Steve Metallitz for Karen. Are there time limits for the AOC and root scaling reviews? You mentioned the one-year review for the URS. Are there time limits for the other ones?
I don't believe so. I particularly don't believe there is for the root scaling study. I haven't found one, at least in trying to compile all of the data on this. But I know that the AOC review does provide for periodic reviews. I think it's every 2 years after the first one. I don't have it in my head right now whether it puts a time limit on the first one. But I don't believe it does.
All right. Thanks, Karen. I had a question with regard to the operational aspects. Do you have a sense as to when you're likely to have more definitive information as to kind of the structure and scope of that review, and in particular, the mechanisms through which the community could provide input?
Yeah, so I think what's been coming out of this meeting is that by the time of the ICANN meeting in London, there would be a more comprehensive plan and sort of scoping out of the rough timeline or rough sequence of events that's expected.
Anyone else have questions for Karen? Nope.
Christina, this is Steve Metallitz. Could I get back in the queue? For
absolutely. Go right ahead, Steve.
Thank you. This is Steve Metallitz. Karen, do any of these reviews include a consideration of whether any of the safeguards developed for new GTLDs should be applied to legacy TLDs? I don't know if any of them specifically outline that, or would those be involved in these reviews? Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. I don't think so, because the you know, so far as the scope is stated in the various places where these things come from, it's really looking at, you know, reviewing the effects of the new GTLD program. So I think, you know, certainly there can be some maybe conclusions or lessons drawn from that that, you know, people might be interested in having discussions about whether they can be applied elsewhere. But in terms of the reviews themselves, I don't think that's generally part of the scope. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Karen. This was really helpful, and we'll certainly be keeping an eye out for what comes out in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I believe, is going to be Margie Milam talking with us about the WHOIS accuracy tool.
Hello, everyone. You guys wanted me to talk about the WHOIS improvements effort, and especially related to a document we've just published for public comment. So that's what we'll be focusing our comments on. I was trying to see if Steve Allison is here. Anyways, he's on ICANN staff and helping develop some of the systems that we're doing with respect to WHOIS, and I was hoping he could also answer some questions, but we'll go ahead. So next slide, please. Okay. So just to provide you a quick overview, when the board adopted the recommendations of the WHOIS review team, it kicked off a two-pronged process, one being to implement the WHOIS review team recommendations so that we could fix the current system, and then also kick off the parallel efforts to define perhaps a new system of dealing with registration data. And that's all the work that you're familiar with respect to the expert working group. I'm not going to talk about that part today. What I'm going to focus on today specifically is what's going on to improve the current WHOIS system. Essentially, what we've been focusing on is enhancing our online systems. We started the WHOIS website, which we published back in Buenos Aires, which was more of an educational tool so that anyone who's interested in WHOIS could really learn about it from a layman's perspective. And so there's a lot of content and information on the WHOIS website. And we're using that as the portal or the central place for all of the additional fixes that are coming with respect to the WHOIS program, and that's being developed in multiple phases. So since Buenos Aires, we've published what we call the WHOIS Primer. And the WHOIS Primer is translated in about five languages, and it's really meant to synthesize the WHOIS requirements into language that's understandable to someone who's not familiar with our contracts and our and can really understand legalese. And so the nice thing about the WHOIS Primer is that it actually contains live links to the contract terms themselves that support some of the obligations that relate to WHOIS. The next thing that's in development is the WHOIS lookup tool. As you may recall, the WHOIS review team had made a recommendation that there be a simpler way of doing WHOIS lookups. And so we're about ready to launch that. It should be in the next 2 weeks, where essentially ICANN has a portal that goes and has a more friendly interface to be able to do a lookup on any GTLD, and so all the new ones are going to be in there as well. And that's scheduled for launch in about 2 weeks. It makes the reporting features are a little easier. It'll eventually include an ability to send an inaccuracy complaint, and so we're really trying to enhance the features and functionality of the WHOIS lookup tool so that we can make it very simple. And so instead of having to go, for example, for a .com to go to the registry and then go to the registrar to do a lookup, it's all seamless. And so that's coming in about 2 weeks. The other thing is the WHOIS online accuracy reporting system. And one of the recommendations from the WHOIS review team was that that we publish statistics related to the WHOIS program and also to be able to track accuracy rates over time. And that's the document that I've, we published before the Singapore meeting, and essentially that document is meant to tell the community how we intend to implement that. And I'll provide some more details in the next slides. So the WHO is accuracy system is meant to be used to proactively identify inaccurate WHO is records. We're going to use automated tools. So we're actually going to engage with commercial validation providers, a commercial of address, telephone, and possibly identity validation. And using these tools, we will forward the inaccurate records to registrars for action. And we will also be publicly reporting on the results of that work. So from an ongoing basis, it's not going to be a one-off system. It'll be, every 3 from 4 months, whatever the time period is, you'll be able to track whether the WHO is accuracy rates are changing over time. And so when we started getting into the development of this system, there were a lot of questions we needed answered, and that's what the document that we posted for public comment really highlights. How do you determine what is accurate? And the WHO is review team in their report referenced the work of the NORC when they did their initial accuracy study many years ago. And part of the problem of just using the proposals that they had used in the past was, first of all, they used a very small scale. I think the sample size was about 1,500 records. It was quite costly. But also, a lot of things have happened since then. The ESAC, for example, came out with a paper that helps define how you look at accuracy and gave us some ways to look at it. For example, you could look at a record for syntactic validation, whether the address is in the right format or the email is in the right format. You might see whether it's operational, whether the email works or was actually a working phone number. Or you could go as far as identity validation, where you're actually confirming that the registrant has indeed, is at that address and, has registered that phone number, as an example. And so we wanted to make sure that this methodology we used took into account this latest, knowledge and also the requirements of the 2013 RAA, because there's now validation requirements, associated with some of the fields. And so we went back to NORC to help get an idea of how we could do this and to use their expertise, and that's what's published in the document for public comment. And we're certainly inviting comment from especially, obviously the intellectual property constituency, because it really, will impact, all the concerns that you guys have with respect to WHO is. And that is what we're trying to do. And we're also trying to come up with a methodology for scoring a record, and then making sure that the reporting we develop provides the kind of information that you'd be looking for. And so I'll provide a little more detail on the next slides. So phase one of the development is, as I mentioned, the WHOIS online search tool, which is about ready to go live. Right after the public comment period closes, we're going to publish an RFP to try to seek out some of these tools, such as, postal address validation, telephone number validation, parsing. We need to be able to take a record and be able to do the kind of analytics we need in order to do the statistical analysis. The second part of that is going to be a little more complicated. It's the part that impacts the contracted parties, the registrars, because depending on the size of the samples that we do, we will be forwarding inaccurate records to registrars for action. And so there may be quite an increase in volume of inaccuracy complaints going to registrars, and we're not even sure that we would use the same format that we use today for the inaccurate record. We may do something else to be able to communicate the results of these findings and to try to get them to follow up on it. And then the other aspect that we need to explore is how it impacts the contractual compliance department, because, just as an example, if you're able to automate looking at address fields for a million records, as an example, and then you identify 100,000 addresses that are inaccurate, it would put a significant burden on whoever happens to be looking at the records, whether it's the compliance team or even the registrars, to determine, what the right processes should be. So a lot of those issues are going to be dealt with in phase two. We'll actually start publishing the results of the analysis before we finalize all of the procedures that relate to phase two, because we have to work with the registrars to be able to get their input on how to best forward the inaccurate records to them. I have to work with the compliance team to make sure that that they understand when they're how they might be impacted and what their role would be, and all of that's still to be worked out. And so if you look at the document that's posted, what NORC did for us was to try to use these concepts and put it in a systematic way so that we could have a standard process that would apply to records. And so they've tried to categorize a record. They've actually gave us lots of examples and gave us with a suggested methodology on how you might look at a WHOIS record to determine whether there's been a failure, a limited failure, a substantial failure, or full failure. And they're assigning a score. Their suggestion is to score it and use the scores as the basis for producing these statistical analysis reports. And so in the documents that we've posted, you can see that they've suggested an approach that would also, look at a record for various aspects consistent with the ESSAC recommendations. So you might score a record for syntactic accuracy. You might score a record for operational accuracy, and you might score for identity. And one of the interesting things with the ability to use automated tools, we might have different sample sizes depending upon what we're looking at. So if we have an automated system that can look at addresses, for example, for cross-field validation, like whether the address is in the street and in the streets in the country and the country is in the state, we might be able to look at a substantially higher number of records than we can for if we're doing identity validation, where you might have to, dig deeper and get additional, information to be able to make that assessment. And so that's all what's explored in the document that we've posted. And then I think this is where we'd especially like input from this group is, once we've, come up with this methodology and implemented it, what is it we would like to report? We're going to look at we're thinking about looking at, for example, geographic regions to see whether the accuracy rates vary via jurisdictions and geographic locations, because that might mean that it's a language issue, or it might mean that we need to spend more time educating registrants in a particular region. We're going to look at size of registries and registrars to see if that impacts accuracy rates. So we might report on, how the accuracy rates vary in among those populations. We'll also compare new versus legacy GTLDs because the new GTLDs are all under the new 2013 RAA. And so, since there are validation requirements now, you may see differing accuracy rates depending upon whether you're on the new contracts versus the old contracts. And then we're still trying to define how frequently we will do this reporting, whether it be biannually or trimester based. That's something that we're trying to figure out how often to do it and what it's going to take to get to the point of being able to publish the results. And so, let's see, did that chart not come out? Okay, well, my timeline, for some reason, I had an error on this. It's not there. We're looking at publishing an RFP in April, closing it in May, selecting vendors in June, and then doing the development cycle so that the first accuracy reports could be available by the end of the year. And then once we get that in place, we will work on, or we'll simultaneously work with registrar, start to work with them on how we're going to do the operational side of transmitting inaccurate records to them. And so that process will take longer. And I've provided some links in the materials so you can see where the public comment forum is. It's open until April 22nd, and because the documents were filed pretty close to the ICANN meeting, if you need more time, we'll welcome comments even during the reply period, for example, and we're not going to, we just want to make sure that we get input from whoever is willing to provide input. And we thought we wanted to be able to use the time in Singapore to be able to share, you know, this information with the community. And so that's essentially my presentation.
Thanks very much. I'll take a cue. Steve, in particular, do you have any questions?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
I do. Thank you. This is Steve Metallitz, and thanks very much for this presentation, Margie. And I'm glad to hear that what I heard you say is that we can treat the reply comment deadline as the initial as our comment deadline, April 22 rather than April 1st. Is that mm-hmm. is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My other question, I mean, you have a lot in here, and there's a lot to comment on. But I'm wondering about, in particular, about the impact of this on the new GTLDs. As you know, the new GTLD program committee told the GAC about 9 months ago that this tool already was in place. And we now have a situation where the new GTLDs are going live, and the GAC had asked for the registries to undertake this sampling and flagging of inaccurate data, and ICANN instead said we'll take that obligation on. Do you know if ICANN has any plans to update the GAC as to the fact that the tool is not yet in place, even though registrations are being taken in the new GTLDs, which was the focus of the GAC advice?
Are you suggesting that we forward this information to the GAC, or I guess I don't understand your question?
Well, the GAC said we want this sampling done in the new GTLDs. That was their advice. ICANN replied that, yes, we agree, but we will do it rather than having the registries do it. And that advice was given many months before any new GTLD went live. Now they are live. The sampling is not in place. So I'm just wondering if there will be an update to the GAC on that issue.
I wasn't aware there was a need to update them on that besides what's in the public comment, but we can certainly do that. I mean, if you think that's something that they'd like to hear, I'll prepare an email for the GAC and let them know.
Okay, thank you. And again, I appreciate your presentation, all the work that you and Chris and Steve have done, and we look forward to preparing some detailed comments on this.
Mark, you have a question?
Mark Trachtenberg with Winston & Strawn. Two questions. First, in your reporting, do you contemplate identifying the registrars that had complaints submitted? Because I think that would be useful for us, but also generally for the community.
You mean identify the accuracy rates per registrar?
Or number of complaints submitted.
This is not the who is inaccuracy reporting system that already exists. So since we're doing proactive lookups, I mean, essentially that's what we're talking about here is proactive lookups. You're talking about when it's forwarded to the registrars, whether, you know.
Right. So you had mentioned that you're going to be tracking the actions
right.
that are taken afterwards.
Right.
So from that perspective, it would be interesting and I think helpful to know how many things were forwarded to a particular registrar and then have information on, for example, how long it took that registrar to fix the problem or identify that there wasn't any inaccuracy or, you know, basically how long it took to resolve the issue.
Okay. We'll take that back. We haven't, as you can tell, haven't scoped out the process once a record gets forwarded to the registrars. We're not trying to build this as a compliance tool, but we did commit to reporting on what happens resulting from forwarding. So if you have suggestions on that, please submit them in the public comment forum, and we'll consider that.
For sure. And just the second part is, I think you suggested that you were going to build into this Whois tool the ability to submit complaints. Inaccuracy complaints directly through the mm-hmm. tool. I mm-hmm. think it would be interesting to have it noted in a particular Whois result if there has been an inaccuracy complaint submitted for that domain name. Mm-hmm. because, you know, it could take some time for that to be resolved. To the extent that the purpose of the tool is to make WHOIS information more available, it would be very useful to know that that information potentially is not accurate, assuming it's not, you know, incredibly obvious.
Yeah, we'll certainly consider that.
Thanks, Mark. Jonathan?
I was going to say something similar to Mark, actually, which is that this group has brought up this issue of interim measures, and it does make it into a kind of a compliance question, interim measures that are sort of non-nuclear in nature. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, when you suggest that you don't know how registrars will necessarily even handle this increased volume, mm-hmm. and how compliance will handle this volume, if there's some statistical reporting that feels like top 10 registrars that have the highest number or something like that, I think that that will in and of itself create some pressure on those registrars while at the same time relieving some of the pressures on compliance. So, I mean, I know you're trying not mm-hmm. to, you're trying to walk a fine line, obviously, mm-hmm. vis-a-vis compliance, but I think a lot of people in this room are very interested in seeing the role that this tool might play in a compliance context. And one of those is essentially a name and shame exercise that's something shy of the more formalized processes that compliance goes through vis-a-vis non-compliant registrars. And in that same vein, those of us that are curious about metrics associated with these mm-hmm. things would be interested in seeing goals, once these statistical analysis is in place, seeing a goal set for changes in WHOIS data accuracy so that we can judge policies and practices, et cetera, that are put in place to address inaccuracies to see if they're working. And I think both of those are things that this group would be interested in seeing.
And that's certainly the thinking behind the tool in the first place, is if everyone knows we're doing these lookups and there's follow-up actions required, that hopefully over time, you know, behavior will change and we will see an increase in accuracy rates. So that would be consistent with that. We'll certainly consider that.
Petter?
Well, first, thank you for good work so far. Although there is a detail that is not solved in your report. It's dealing with another working group that's actually somewhat waiting for your final solution as translation and transliteration working group. And I just wonder if you have any recommendations or comments for us based on what you have seen so far.
The issue of translation and transliteration is very complicated. Even the expert working group from, you know, I also staff that group, you know, is essentially deferring that discussion to the group that the PDP is doing. Just so you know, the WHOIS review team recommendations included making reports on, you know, that relate to internationalized registration data. So whenever the policy gets developed and implemented, we will be expanding the system to also be able to, you know, check accuracy rates in non-ASCII, you know, records. And so, you know, it's a tough question.
You want to close the queue? Okay, we're going to close the queue there in the interest of time.
Oh, wait.
Right. I'm sorry. There's a remote participation question. From Michael Graham, if this is not being built as a compliance tool, are there separate efforts to do so? Is this merely for a study of the metrics?
I guess you could ask that question to Maggie. I don't have insight into what systems they're developing. It's more than metrics because, as I mentioned, we are forwarding the records to registrars for action and we'll be reporting on the results. So it's kind of a mix, a quasi-mix. I think probably the best person to ask about the compliance tools would be Maggie, and I'm sure she's probably speaking to you later, maybe?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for letting me speak to you about this.
Thanks very much, Margie.
going to take a minute to get the slides uploaded. Sorry.
It will. Oh, come on. All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Maggie Surad, and I'm from Contractual Compliance. With me in the audience, I have Owen Smigelski. Owen's role has expanded to oversight of all the registrar areas. We've changed some roles and responsibilities to bring more focus in our team based on all the activities that we've been having lately. Also with me in the audience, I have Sumi Lee. She's mostly focused on the registry space, but Sumi is also very knowledgeable in registrar. We have Yang Cheng and Roger Lim from the Singapore office. Very brief presentation, and then we'll open it up for Q&A as we do usually. Our global presence is now in Singapore and Turkey, so compliance is open 6 days a week, 24 hours a day, based on the time zone differences. And this has been very a major step for us, finding the right talent in the right locations. And we have the foundation to where now we can truly perform our function in a consistent and efficient way, consistent across the process, consistent across the communication, the templates, the tracking, and the correspondence. Since we last met, we have completed all the 2013 RAA and new registry agreement readiness. What I mean by that is if you've been to our website, actually, I heard Steve, I'm sad not to see you in the office, Metalis, but he's provided us already input on some of our learn mores. But we have built all the web forms needed to receive complaints from the ICANN community or to receive reports. We also have built all the learn mores, which are another way of saying frequently asked questions. We have the templates for the communication, for the notices and the inquiries all put together. Staff has been trained. As we all know, training is ongoing because it's going to be built as we receive and continue to work in this space. The learn mores are in the process of being translated to the six UN languages. Our audit program in year two is in progress. By ICANN 50, we will present to the ICANN community our audit report year two, and also we will be presenting to the ICANN community what is compliance doing in preparation for the audit plan and the details of the audit plan for the new registry agreement. If you are familiar with who is inaccuracy submission, on our website you can submit single complaints, you can submit multiple complaints. I should have labeled that one Christina's complaints. And then we also have the bulk, who is inaccuracy submission, which is a authenticated access provided to those interested parties. They have to contact us. They have to share with us what is their reason they want to do it. And we review and validate it and give them access. It allows them to upload a file. Initially, we started with 100 complaints per user per week to ensure quality. Because quality is really important from a workload balance. but also to ensure that the users are comfortable with the tool and how it all works together. We have had requests to increase it, and now it's increased to 300 users per week. All these complaints go through the same process. We do track them bulk versus individual because we want to just see the statistics, where we are, where's the usage, and where's the traffic coming from. But they do go through the same process and the same scrutiny and validation. I think in this forum or hallway conversations last time, there was some audience here interested in knowing what and how we close, what are the closure codes associated when we close complaints, whether we close them at the beginning or we close them at the end. There was some interest on what are those closure codes and what is the percentage. And we've provided those slides for you. We will not review them, but if you have questions, let us know. I wanted to share with you a few slides here. Jonathan, this is for you. Learn more and my ICANN web page views. You know, sometimes we had people say, well, why are you doing all these learn mores? What's the value? What is it going? We've seen a really value in that. First of all, a lot of learn mores have directed our ICANN community to the right places because they now can read. What is it? I think I need to file this. But when they read more about it, they are more informed and it directs them. But most importantly now, look in the last 2 months, the web views we've had on the learn mores. And we have received some what I call feedback to improve it or to improve the language or some questions about it. On the bottom is their web page views related to the compliance metrics that we have under my ICANN. With this, I'm going to turn the mic to Owen. What we're bringing to this audience are topics related to compliance and enforcement as it relates to the enhancements due to the 2013 RAA. We want you to be aware of what are these, what are we doing, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Maggie. So the 2013 RAA, more specifically the Who Is Accuracy Program specification, has a significantly more requirements for registrars, and we are certainly seeing growing pains, at least internally for staff. We've had to do a lot more training on this, as well as registrars, and if anybody was at the registrar stakeholder group session this morning, they heard a lot of that. So we are making the registrars do additional things and as well as show us the steps that are being taken. So one thing that is in there is that email addresses must be verified or re-verified at the time of registration, as well as when there's a Who Is Accuracy complaint, even if the complaint is not about the email address itself. So if there's a complaint about an address, a postal address, the email must be re-verified as well, too. Another addition in there is that domain names must be suspended, or the registrar must do a manual verification if there's no response from the registrant. It used to be that they could just say that the reasonable steps was to send an email, but now they actually do have to do something or suspend it. We're going to keep the first notice to be 15 business days. The 2013 RAA does away with business days, and everything is calendar days, and there's 15 calendar days that they must take action with regards to who is verification and validation, but just due to timing and weekends and things like that, we're going to keep it at 15 business days. However, starting with the second notice, we will inquire why the registrar did not suspend the domain name if it has not been corrected or has not been suspended at that point. And so for the Who Is inaccuracy complaints, there's now two parallel tracks that the registrars must do. And this slide illustrates that. There's a Who Is inaccuracy complaint about whatever address, telephone number, any tech admin registrant. The registrar must verify the email address and take steps to investigate the complaint. So you see on the left side, there must be an affirmative response from the registrant for the email verification. Previously, it was acceptable to just send an email and say it didn't bounce. Now there must be an affirmative response from the registrant, a phone call, clicking a link, replying to the email. And absent that, the domain must be suspended. The other track, these are the three responses that compliance is looking for from the registrar. One, that the WHOIS was updated and validated. For now, that means just that each field is validated as required by the WHOIS accuracy specification. The cross-field validation is not there yet. That's part of a separate working group. And that what that'll mean is that it'll check to see if it's a street, is it in the city, in the country, et cetera. But for now, it just checks to see is it a correct, proper format. The other option is that the registrar can suspend or that the registrar verified correct and validated. So each of those two parallel tracks, if there's no response by 15 calendar days, the registrar must suspend the domain. Another thing we've been seeing some increased issues with is that the differences between a privacy service and a proxy service. There is a specification now in the 2013 RAA about this. It's temporary until the privacy proxy working group comes up with something before the 2017 deadline. But what we've been seeing is some confusion regarding what is a privacy service. That must actually show the registrant's name versus a proxy service where that is the registrant and licenses the domain to a beneficial user. And so we've been doing a lot with regards to who is in accuracy complaints of getting those resolved and addressed to actually either show the actual registrant or making sure that it is a proxy service that is a separate legal entity from the registrar. And additionally, that information must be verified and validated per the 2013 RAA. Another thing that the 2013 RAA has is abuse reports. There's two components to Section 3.18. The first part, the registrars must accept abuse reports. They must have an email address on their website. The WHOIS output must have a email address and a telephone number. Registrars must take reasonable prompt steps to investigate and respond appropriately. It's not something that they can just sit on and not do anything, but we do look for, when we have these kind of complaints, is did the reporter provide specific information for them to take action? And just of note, this is has to deal with complaints, abuse complaints that are outside the scope of the contracts or the consensus policies, so it's not appropriate to make a trademark a report for an abuse. That would still have to go through the UDRP. There's also some law enforcement. They have special access. They have different access numbers, and the registrars have to respond within 24 hours for that. Next slide. This is just a summary of the 12 new complaint types that we've built into our ticket processing system. And there's links on there to the references to all the different sections of the RAA that covers those.
We've also attached a slide for the registry complaint types that exist today on the website, and they all have associated Learn More for your reference. With this, I wanted to just remind everyone, if you're really interested in the compliance program, you can hear it all in depth. Tomorrow we have an hour and a half session, of which the first 30 minutes to 45 minutes staff will present to you much more detailed information about the activities, the trends, the data that we saw since the last meeting, and then we will allow a 45-minute session for question and answer. So if you're available, please join us. With that, I would like to turn it for questions, Christina.
All right, I'll go ahead and take a cue. Okay. All right, I see Greg, I see Jonathan, I see Paul. Anyone on the phone? All right, let's go ahead and start with that, and I'll revisit the cue.
Greg Shatton. This is somewhat of a specific compliance question, but it relates to an issue that's been a kind of matter of ongoing discussion in the IPC based on at least one specific example of this. I've noticed potential registries offering basically jump the line pre-sunrise priorities, which don't seem to be allowed by RAA. Or rather by the RA, as a specific example, one of the three .sucks applicants, which is offering a $25,000 sunrise, is also offering a $2,500 trademark priority pay right now, even though they're only one of three in a contention set. And if you pay the $2,500 now, you will be allocated the domain name before the trademark priority even starts. This strikes me as out of compliance, yet another version of kind of gaming the system here and perhaps getting enough money for a nice Caribbean vacation. I don't know if they're forced to put that kind of money in escrow or if they can put it into their general operating budget. But the whole thing just kind of smacks of you know, wild gamesmanship. I don't know if this is a question of maybe they're complying with the letter of the contract, maybe the fact that they haven't, that they're only an applicant, they don't have a contract, doesn't really matter, but the whole thing kind of sucks. Thank you.
Hi, this is Sumi Lee for the record. We don't get into the pricing aspects, obviously, because we're compliance. We're not part of what happens at that level. But if it is an issue related to the contract and the provisions in the contract, certainly you can submit a complaint on our web form, and we would look into it and address that.
Well, putting aside the pricing issue, what about the issue of offering a trademark priority before the trademark sunrise?
Well, like I said, if it's a complaint and you have facts to support it, then compliance would look into
it.
Put it
up on the screen if you want.
Oh. Well.
This is Owen. I think you're talking about an applicant in contention set that has not yet signed a contract. Yeah.
That's correct.
So there's nothing we can do until it's a contracted party.
They're pre-contractual.
Until it's a contracted party, it's outside of our...
We'll have to wait for the pox to hit the shores before we can cure it.
Or you could send it to Julie Brill. I think the next person in the queue was Jonathan, and then I had Paul McGrady. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi. Thank you for devoting a slide to me. I appreciate that. And I guess what you were showing there was that lots of people are reading your FAQs, right? That was the point there, which I think is really good, because I know that part of what you've discussed in the past is that a lot of compliance issues might come down to coaching and better education and things like that. And so I'm excited that you're building those tools to do that. And I guess I'm going to say what I always say, because that's how you become metrics man, is by repeating yourself, is that I'd be really interested in looking at some benchmarks for some of these kinds of complaints and processes and the response to these things, so that we can get a baseline of how they're doing and then set objectives for improving them and then compare the results to those projections. That's really what I'm after, more so than just this live data, which is this notion of here's where we're seeing problems, right? I know at one point you were showing that there were differences geographically, for example, and so one could identify that was a problem. So then I'd be interested in here's what we're going to do to try to tackle this problem, and this is what we hope will be the impact on those statistics. And then a year later, we look at that and see if it worked, and if it didn't, then here's our new plan. And that's really more what I'm trying to get at.
Paul, and then Alex.
After a number of years, the IPC has finally figured out not to put a microphone near my seat. Two questions, and one's just come out of this recent conversation, and this is just purely for my own edification. ICANN's taking the position that the registry, the applicant terms and conditions, are not a contract. So if you have an applicant, with the .sucks applicant, it looks to us like they've gone off the reservation a bit. I mean, there is a contract, isn't there, or not?
So we're answering from our scope. I don't know what is before. Once a contract is signed and they get delegated, and then we are in effect. Krista, do you know? Can you answer Paul's question? Well, we can get back to you, Paul. If Christina, can you? Somebody's describing. You can send us that question. Yeah. We'll follow up on it.
Okay. Thank you. Because I'm pretty sure I saw some contracty looking things in that application process.
So basically, once we submit the compliance report, they're still applicants. We submit a compliance report. It's reviewed. They pass that process. Then they get to the signing of the contract. When they sign the contract and they get delegated, that's when we become effective and we start enforcing the contract.
So any contract with ICANN by an applicant is not part of your...
That's not what I'm saying. I'm speaking on behalf of compliance's scope. So we'll need to get back to you on the any contract signed by an applicant before, you know, as an applicant.
Okay.
So when we speak of a signed contract in contractual compliance, they're no longer an applicant. They are now a registry operator. They are operating a TLD.
Right, but the registry agreement is, I think, the second contract that's involved, but okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark's raised his hand.
No, I have a second question, but I'm curious about what Mark's question is because it may relate to this specifically.
Well, let's just keep it in order.
Unlikely? Okay. And then secondly, this has to do, this is much more mundane. Closures, how does that work? Are they reviewed by somebody before they closure? Because I've gotten, since Buenos Aires, I got a closure notice where it said, we've closed your fake whois complaint, and the reason for this is quotation marks. And so I wrote back and said, I don't know what quotation marks means. And then it was reopened, and now the domain name is suspended. So how does that work? Who's pushing the button?
Yeah, I can speak to that. If you're talking with regards to a whois inaccuracy complaint, our system part of the functionality and the automation is for those complaints, it does periodically check to see if the domain has been suspended, and if it's removed from the DNS, then that satisfies the complaint and it will close automatically, and that closure notice does go out just for those ones that are auto-resolved. All the other ones that are done manually are selected and chosen by staff, and then that's processed out. You had the lucky opportunity of catching one of our hiccups as we were doing a process. We did some recent patching, and it was identified that was going out. We did an emergency patch, and that was resolved, and you should not encounter that anymore. If you do, rather than replying to the ticket, please forward it to compliance@icann.org, because we don't really necessarily go back and look at the complaints that have been closed. But if you do see something like that, if there's something operationally we do a lot of testing before this stuff rolls out, but sometimes those things do happen.
I'm merely earning my title of canary in the cage.
So I have Alex, Mark. I'm going to put myself in the queue. Is there anyone else that wants to be in the queue? Okay, Claudio and Karen, and then we're going to close the queue. Wait, anybody behind me? Nope? Okay. Go ahead, Alex.
Hi, my name is Alex Deacon. I'm wondering if you could tell us what compliance is doing to enforce the PIC specifications.
It's the hot topic of this ICANN meeting. You know, we always look at what's the ICANN message here. So for the PIC enforcement, as you know, we've been talking about it. We work in directly with the DNS engagement team because from a business perspective, they've laid out the procedures. And if you've read the PIC DRP, it kind of steps through all the steps, what it takes. You know, a report is filed with compliance. Compliance reviews the report, and then it's with the registry, 30 days to work it with the reporter. So if I may just take at a big level, and then I can turn it to Sumi. Compliance is doing two things. Think of it of what we call a proactive approach, which will be us going and picking, basically reviewing or auditing the TLD on their picks. That's one approach. And in this trimester, we're finalizing that plan, and we plan to initiate a few of those reviews to see how in compliance they are with it. Another aspect is when we receive a report of a non-compliance in the PIC, then we will follow up and follow through per the reported process to ensure that it gets into compliance. Do you want more specifics? And what would you like to know?
No, I think that's fine. I mean, this process is available and up and running and now.
Yes, yes. What we're working on, again, to be transparent, we focus, anytime we have a new kind of an issue or a problem, we refer to everything in complaint types, okay? Even we generate complaints to ourselves. When we are in the process of monitoring or reviewing, or sometimes one complaint can lead to something else and we explore and investigate, we create tickets. The reason we do that, again, for consistency, for tracking, and for process efficiency there. But what we do also is we always focus on what's public-facing. It's really important to allow the ICANN community to reach into compliance and let us know of an issue. That's our very number one focus. After we stabilize that and launch it, then we focus on the audit. Now, validation is consistent because once you start validating on a complaint type, building the audit plan and the audit program is stems from those. So right now what we're doing is building an audit plan. We're going to detail it for the new registry agreement, but a subset of that audit plan will be an audit of the PICs. And by ICANN 50, God willing, we'll see you there and we will share. We're going to have a very intense audit session reporting, as I said at the very beginning, on the year two audit, but also reporting on what are the activities for the new registry agreement audit plan, and PIC will be a subset of that.
Okay, thank you.
Mark, you're next.
Mark Trachtenberg, Winston & Strawn. So ZACR, which is the applicant for .Joburg, .Durban, and .Cape Town, and this is an issue that I've raised before to ICANN, although to be fair, not to compliance. They have publicly announced for some time now that they're offering an alternative to the Trademark Clearinghouse, which is clearly prohibited under the RPMs and the registry agreements. ICANN has confirmed that that's not prohibited, but this has been out there for many, many months, this public claim on their website that they're gonna offer this. You know, what, if anything, will compliance do about this issue?
Is this working?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Could you repeat the question about, or the last part of your question?
I was just asking what compliance will do about this situation, since they're clearly in violation of the RPMs and the registry agreements.
Well, we haven't received a complaint about that. And I'm not sure.
Can this constitute my complaint?
Sure.
All right.
Well, submit a complaint on our web form. I'm not.
Is the implication, though, that unless you guys receive a complaint, that you cannot take action on a specific issue? I'm just trying to understand.
I don't think it's so black and white that way. I think what we're talking about is we have to follow a process so that we are accountable, the community and to IPC and all the other stakeholder groups. If we don't have documentation and a way to track that particular complaint, when it came in, who complained about it, what the allegations are, you know, I'm sure most of the all the attorneys or everybody in here knows that you have to have evidence, and this is the way that we track that. So we're not doing it to make it difficult for you or minimize the severity or the time issue involved. It's more about our accountability. So if there is a genuine issue, well, even if there isn't, you know, we are here to investigate and analyze whether there's a valid complaint and that a violation of the contract occurred. So if
basically
you
let us know. It's like, do we have to file? It's not a question of filing a complaint. It's a question, how would we know about it? You're closer to the issue. Now, unless we're running an audit, conducting an audit, then we can identify those more proactively. And like I said, the audit program, it's not there yet. So if you discover and you find out issues of that nature closer to your area of interest and concerns, mm-hmm. please let us know. And the way to let us know is to go on the ICANN.org website and file a report or a complaint. If there is not a category there that's clearly obvious to you, first of all, let us know. That's feedback that we've received, like I said, from many people.
Sure.
But there is a way to send an email to compliance@ICANN.org, and we will respond to you. We will personally enter the complaint and do it.
And definitely, Mark, if a registry operator or if they're violating the terms of their registry agreement, of course, that is an action or compliance action that can be taken. And we would not, dismiss that. But there are only so many hours in the day and so many staff members, even if we are working many difficult hours into the night, we can't keep track of everything that's going on, like with the Trademark Clearinghouse. So we would appreciate the community's feedback and your input. Okay.
All right. I'm going to take myself out of the queue. This is a last call for questions. Then we're going to close the queue. Can you stay? Because I know we're actually over your time. Do you have to be somewhere else?
We have a meeting.
Okay. All right.
It's our roadshow day today.
Okay. So why don't we do this? I had in the queue Kieran, Claudio, Steve, Jonathan, and Greg. You can do 5 minutes. All right. Kieran, why don't we stick to the queue, and then whatever questions we have, folks, they'll just have to, I guess, email them to Maggie. And why don't you copy the IPC list so that that way we all see what the question and answer is. Kieran, go ahead.
So really quickly, I had a point about the applicants not being subject to compliance. I think that this... that's a huge problem because and a huge hole because the it then kind of reeks of a we're not going to take action until the genie is out of the bottle kind of a thing. Because with .zacr, for example, once they're approved and they launch this alternative trademark clearinghouse, and you know they're accepting pre-registrations possibly and all of these things, you know, then how do you rein all of that back in? You know, so I think there probably needs to be a mechanism, maybe Paul's suggestion that they're already contractually obligated to ICANN is you know, something we don't know, right? But you know, I think that needs to be addressed and looked into. And my second point also quickly is, you know, there are a lot of pre-registration schemes going on at the registrar level where they give a kind of alternative trademarks claims notification, which is non-compliant with the trademark claims notifications that we agree to in the RPM requirements. And I know that there have been complaints submitted to ICANN compliance, yet it's still going on. And that also kind of reeks as a genie out of the bottle thing, because it's like you have to do a notification for what, every single registration that gets through that doesn't have a claims notification. I'm not sure why it hasn't been stopped yet. And so I'm wondering what compliance solution is for that to stop the flow of these kind of inadequately notified registrations. Thanks.
We're not seeing a flow. We have some reports on that, and we have been able to follow up. There are some that are still in review. You know, that's I don't have any more to add to that.
So there's no way to stop, put the hold on, or I mean the practice on hold while you look into the complaints you've received? You're just going to allow them to keep doing what they're doing until you are done with the complaint?
So they have not been breached, so we're still reviewing, and a lot of the times it gets corrected and it becomes into compliance. So are you talking about the bigger picture or a specific? Again, I'm not sure what is it we need to hold. I mean, signed an agreement. Unless they've been breached and they have not cured their breach, we can't take it to another level of enforcement.
Our point is that the trademark claims notifications that they're giving are in breach, and that's the practice that needs to be put on hold.
Yeah, I think if I let me just take a different angle of it. If someone puts in a complaint to compliance about inadequate or incomplete trademark claim notification, you don't act on it until you've reviewed it. If after that period of time you review the complaint, determine that there is in fact a breach, what happens to all those registrations where the registrant should have gotten a trademark claims notice or should have gotten an accurate trademark claims notice and didn't? Is there then an obligation on the registrar to go back and re-notify? That's kind of what do you do about the gap, I think, is really the question. Did I get that right?
That's correct. What do you do with the registrations? And also, I would argue that to be on the safe side, compliance, once they receive a notification that hypothetically GoDaddy is doing is giving inadequate trademarks claim notifications, why doesn't compliance say, hey, you need to stop these pre-registration schemes until we determine whether your notification is in compliance, so that we don't allow in 1,000 pre-registrations that match a trademark claim where there's no relationship or no assent to the official trademarks claim notification by the registrant?
Your question can apply to who is inaccuracy. If a registrar has a bad who is inaccuracy, stop adding new registrants. So, you know, we've got to The problem can really propagate to...
Yes, it sure can, and maybe
yeah,
will.
But, you know, we have enforcement tools, but I'm sorry to inform you, it is not that to that level.
Maggie, I don't know whether we... Well, Steve Metalitz had posted a question in the Adobe chat. Who is in charge of selecting panelists for the PIC DRP panels?
I can answer that. That would be Registry Services. They pick the standing panel. They choose them.
So the people within ICANN whose clients are the registries pick the panels that are going to decide whether the registries are in compliance?
I'm sorry. So this effort is led by the DNS engagement team with Krista. And we have been providing input like we do on the contract, on the policies, on everything else that goes on. We provide input, and then we put our processes and our criteria in place there.
Thank you. I know we still have people in the queue. Defer to you as to whether you have to go. You have to go.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Jonathan and Greg, if you would send your questions to Maggie, copy the IPC list, and then Maggie... You know, when the reply comes back, if you could respond to the list as well, that would be super. And I'm sure you will see many of us at the session tomorrow. So, as always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. And let me remind you all, you know, we've delegated before, but it was one at a time or whatever, every 2 years. The volume is totally different now. The concern is at a much higher level of intensity, and I have an appreciation for your concerns. But please, let's keep the communication channel open. We want to do our job to the best of what we're capable of. And if we find any challenges, we will report back. But we were working really tightly with Cyrus's team to make sure that we are stepping up to the expectations of this community. So thank you. We'll see you tomorrow then.
All right. Thanks, Maggie. Folks, we're going to take a couple-minute break. While we transition to the closed session of our meeting, folks who are on the phone, you're going to have to hang up and dial back in with the passcode that I had sent to the list.